Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast. My name is Cody Cook, and my guest today is Jane Claire Tyner. And I did pronounce that last name correctly, did I?
Dead.
Okay, good. Yeah. I assumed it was like Tyler, but just with an N.
Right.
And so you're the communications manager at End It for Good, which is a nonprofit advocating for health-centered approaches to drug use and addiction. There's going to be some overlap in the approach of End It for Good with our kind of libertarian and grace-filled Christian approaches to addiction. So because of that, I'm really excited to work through some, talk to you and work through together some of the misconceptions we might have about drug addiction and how to I think, respond to it as a society. As an aside, listeners may have heard another interview with Jane on the Protestant Libertarian Podcast, since we do share some audience members. But I've made an effort to explore some new areas. So this won't just be a repeat of that interview. There'll be some, I think, different stuff to discuss. And so hopefully they'll complement each other well. So Jane, I want to thank you for being here to speak with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. Well, so before we get into the weeds, just maybe give me an elevator pitch for what End It for Good is doing.
So as you stated, we're an education and advocacy-based nonprofit organization based in Mississippi, and we introduce people to health-centered approaches for drugs. And we do that for a couple of reasons. One, we believe that such approaches align with our values, and two, the evidence bears out that they create better outcomes, not just for individuals experiencing problematic drug behaviors, but for those who love them and for the communities around them.
That's good. So now someone who's listening who may be more sort of skeptical of the way you would approach this sort of thing, they would say, well, you know, health-based outcomes, are we you know, sort of being soft and coddling people when we need to have more of a tough love approach? You know, is there a way that you guys would sort of answer a question like that?
I don't know, if we would answer a question like that in a certain way, I could answer for how
sure.
I would answer that question. I think first, when you began to look at it from a tough love approach, I think we really miss the complexities of what's going on when we see problematic drug use. There's so many factors that are going on at play. So the idea of a book up tough love approach, I think it doesn't see the whole picture of what's going on with the whole person while they're in that position. As a Christian, I would say, you know, God gave us the law. We had the Pentateuch, and he still sent us Jesus. And as a Christian, my entire faith is based on the fact that I needed the sacrificial salvation of Jesus in addition to the law. It wasn't that the law wasn't perfect. There was anything wrong with the law. And I think that when we look at the human condition, that is what we see. It's this very complex individual that does need some grace. And I don't think that we can look at drug use from any other lens.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you know, someone who may be inclined to sort of think that we solve all our problems through the force of law, maybe missing something about their own Christian faith, perhaps that would nuance that a little bit. Okay, so when we first talked about scheduling this interview, I was given a book by your organization called Curious, A Foster Mom's Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction. And it was written by End It for Good's founder, Christina Dent. And it was a really good book. What I liked about it was that it gave kind of in story form the sort of the impetus and the mission for End It for Good. And so what I might do is start with just kind of a few questions that were inspired by that book, because I think it's a good jumping off point. So would that be okay?
Yeah, of course.
All right. So in Curious, Christina Dent says that, so she talks about having a very positive childhood. She's got a two-parent home. Parents love each other, stable home life, homeschooled by Christian parents, right? So keeps her away from the public school environment in a sort of a rough neighborhood. And so some would describe her young life as privileged, maybe with a kind of a sneer, right? And ultimately, I think we'd like for everyone to have those kinds of opportunities, but the reality is that not everybody does. So if there's one downside, I think, to having this kind of experience, it's that maybe it limits your ability to understand those who do have a different experience, which is what she speaks about herself. you know, her experience created kind of a black and white picture of the world where all people are kind of either good people who make good choices or bad people who make bad choices, right? And the bad people who make bad choices deserve to be punished, you know, by the law or whatever. And as I was reading this, I was thinking about something that the Apostle Paul talks about in his epistle to the Romans, where he has this sort of more complicated understanding about sin, that it's like, it's kind of like, it's not just something we do that we deserve, you know, that we become guilty for. It's actually something that kind of enslaves and ensnares us, right? That we're sort of born into a world that's sinful, and there's, you know, systems and patterns and, you know, societies and those kind of grab us, you know, sin sort of grabs us through those things, right? And, you know, for many people, you know, things like, you know, corrupt social orders, economic status, family patterns, they can be really decisive for the decisions we make. We're not mm-hmm. born as blank slates. So it's a lot easier to make good decisions in good circumstances and a lot easier to make bad decisions in bad circumstances, right? So so I think there's a lot of benefits to a good upbringing and a loving, stable home. It seems that maybe one potential drawback of it is that it can kind of blind us to the struggles and experiences of others. Is that one thing that you kind of have to work through to, I think, to reach people as you're communicating the message of End It for Good, that there's a certain group of people who have maybe had some advantages as far as this is concerned, and it makes it a lot easier for them to maybe judge those who maybe don't have their experience or who've, you know, have these sort of, as I say, you know, sometimes people say that you don't have a drug problem, you have a drug solution. You have other problems that you're trying to fix with drugs. Is that a big barrier, I think, for you guys to communicate your message to people?
We certainly, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive of not having greater insight or empathy into other people's life circumstances if you haven't experienced them yourself. But it can make it more difficult. It's you know, we do have to walk in someone else's shoes for a little while. Often, as Christina experienced, you know, she really didn't know anyone who'd struggled with drug use prior to meeting Joanne and fostering her son Beckham. And so it did give a human face to the issue. And I can share data and statistics with people all day long, but when they see someone else tell their story, that is where we begin to see the process of hearts changing. And then with the data, we see minds changing. But that heart connection is key. So it's a part of our work is knowing that sharing that human component is how we do get change. And when we change hearts and change minds, we change policy. So I think it's difficult because of maybe certain tendencies to sequester, particularly maybe within evangelical circles. No, I don't. I think that especially right now, we're in a place where so few people aren't removed from the situation anymore, one way or another. We have such a epidemic of addiction in the country right now that there are very few people who can say, you know, I just don't know anybody. Somebody, most all of us know someone. You know, they're not several degrees of separation anymore. And that's certainly opening doors for having these conversations because people are very aware that what we are doing and what we've been doing isn't working.
So you were where, yeah. So economic status used to be one of those things that we saw as kind of separating people that, you know, that this is drugs are a problem for poor people, for inner city people, whatever. It's not really a problem for me or for people that I know, right?
Right.
We're seeing that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
So thinking in terms of, you know, what brings people to addiction, so Christina's transition of thought on drug policy for her, what the experience she talks about was her experience as a foster parent, that she and her husband took in a baby who'd been taken from his mother because of her drug addiction, newborn. And when Christina met the mother, she expected to find someone who didn't care about her child. She sort of had this, you know, this kind of negative stereotype of the kind of unconcerned drug addicted parent, you know. And what she found instead was someone who did struggle with addiction, but who also actually loved her son and was concerned about him. And that sort of surprised her, that sort of complicated dichotomy. And it made her question whether people who struggle with addiction are just flat out bad people, whether that's maybe just too simplistic of a narrative. And that question began a journey that led her to Dr. Bruce Alexander and Rat Park. So can you talk a little bit about Rat Park and how that informs our understanding of addiction?
Sure. So Rat Park is a really important study in addiction science. It happened in the 1970s. And Dr. Bruce Alexander, who is a psychologist, a specialist in addiction, was doing research on addiction, looking at all the previous addiction experiments. And what he realized was that most of them were conducted by having single rat in a very small enclosure that had access to water or drugs. And that was all they had. And his knowledge of rats was, wait a second, these are very social creatures. What happens if we change the environment? We still offer them the drugs, the sweetened water with morphine, and we offer them water, but we also give them friends, we give them mates, we give them activities, we enlarge the space by which they can run. What happens? And what he found was that overwhelmingly, the rats who were in this environment that was more like their environment where they could enjoy the things that rats enjoy, they didn't choose the drug-laced water. And so it really began to change our perception that certain drugs, humans, if they touch them, they're automatically going to become addicted. Because the rats would try the sweet water, the morphine, but they wouldn't get addicted to it. They wouldn't use it in so much that it got in the way of the other experiences that they like to have. If it interfered with the other things that they were doing, they wouldn't take it. So he went on to do several studies with these rat models, and it really did transform the idea that that it is only a medical condition, right? That addiction really is so much more. There's so many mitigating factors in the beginning and on the front end that determine whether or not someone is going to become is going to start using drugs in a way that's not beneficial. So it really did change a lot of perception there. And he came up with a great term that I love called the demon drug myth in doing this, that there are certain substances that if they are ingested, they are automatically addictive. And what his studies found and subsequent studies found is that's absolutely not the case. These same substances other people can do and not develop problematic behaviors around them. But yet we still create a lot of policies based on the idea of this demon drug myth, right? That certain substances, no matter what, are going to be disastrous across the board. So while we made a lot of strides with addiction medicine, we haven't really found that catch up to our policies. But it's a great study. We actually have a podcast. Christina did interview Dr. Alexander, and we have a podcast, episode 19 or 20, and it's really good. And he goes into greater detail about that if anybody'd like more information.
What's the name of your guys' podcast?
It's just the End It For Good podcast.
Okay, awesome. Great.
Yeah.
I'll make sure I put that in the links. Actually, I'm going to make a note of that right now as I'm thinking about it. So, yeah, and it seems like what's going on here is that we are not maybe aware of the fact that there are variables, that we've sort of isolated one component and we've ignored the fact that there are other things that are related here. And one thing is I was thinking about as you were speaking is, you know, illicit drugs are similar to other drugs in that they are used as a way to medicate. And so if someone has an emotional or a mental problem, they might seek Zoloft, they might do this or that, or they might turn to illicit drugs, right? And so when you think of it sort of in those terms, you know, somebody who's not dealing with depression is not going to take Zoloft. And if they do, they won't take it for very long. But really that drug becomes a way of dealing with the problem for them, that they're trying to medicate themselves. By sort of isolating the medication, I think that's one example that I think that that was mentioned, that Christina mentions in the book, is that finding out that fentanyl was being used in hospitals, right? And it's like, well, hold on a second. If fentanyl is this thing that just kills everybody it touches, then why are we using it in hospitals? Like, well, when you use it in the right circumstances, in the right way, right. It's not that way. It really just depends on who's using it, how they're using it, and what, you know, how it's controlled. I think that's a really good insight with Rad Park.
One of the things that, I think you pronounce his name Gabor Mate, but he's also another addiction specialist, and he has a great quote that is, it's impossible to understand addiction without asking what relief the addict finds or hopes to find in using the substance. And that really is a very basic principle that we have to start with, is understanding that this is an attempt to alleviate pain. And it should inform how we treat every aspect of drugs.
Yeah. 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 That's a good point. So people will start taking drugs for a reason. It's not something they accidentally do and then suddenly they're addicted to it. Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, Christina also in the book gives a look into how the justice system, which I'll do in quotes, deals with drug offenses. And so she recounts, her first time in a courtroom. Well, she was there to support a friend. She was watching these sort of just different cases flood through very quickly. And she witnessed one case. It was a man who was before the judge for a nonviolent drug offense. And he was there with his pregnant girlfriend. She was there to, you know, support him and sort of give a witness testimony or impact, maybe an impact testimony. And so she appealed to the judge to not allow her baby to grow up without a dad. And the judge listens, you know, kind of disinterestedly, and then he proclaims a 16-year sentence and he moves on to the next case. And, you know, this, I think, was also, I think, maybe a paradigm shift for Christina in sort of seeing the world through this kind of more conservative lens that's really about kind of, you know, imposing moral order through law. That's just kind of the way our system works, that you have to do it in order to deal with the problem, and it actually is very effective. And so I think what Christina sort of learned here was that we have a system that looks to punish nonviolent offenders with extreme prejudice. And she makes an argument that I think libertarian listeners to Libertarian Christian Podcast would appreciate. And it's that, you know, in contradiction to the conservatives who say, you know, well, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Christina points out that 16 years in prison is not actually a natural consequence for drug use, right? It's a choice that we as a society, or that we through our government, or that our government makes. And then imposes upon drug users, right? So as a result, when the government puts an addict in an environment that will, speaking of prisons and jails, that will increase their chances of staying addicted and make it more difficult for them to succeed in life when they get out, not to mention make it impossible for them to care for their families and, you know, take care of their kids. Those are actually consequences of what the government did. Those aren't really the consequences of somebody having a drug problem. And so can you speak to, you know, the moral imperative of reexamining what we're doing, you know, along with its rightness and efficacy, as opposed to just sort of making excuses for the status quo and justifying whatever government does, that I think is an unfortunate, I think we sort of get used to the way things are and it seems normal to us. And then we sort of want to defend it because it seems like, you know, that's the status quo, and what else would you do, right? And so, you know, thinking about that sort of status quo and making excuses for it, trying to defend it, just trying to justify it. I mean, what role does actually sort of stepping back and saying, how effective and how moral is what we're doing really? I mean, can you speak to the value of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we just take the moral piece out of it, take that out of the equation and just look at it from a practical sense and look at it from a financially conservative lens. Is it beneficial? We don't see that it is. We see that prison sentences usually lead to more prison sentences. There are no great outcomes that come from incarcerating anyone. And we did a study that we released last year called Healthy and Hired, and it's about the impact of our drug laws in Mississippi on our workforce. And in 2022, 37% of prison admissions in Mississippi were for drug charges. And half of those were just possession charges alone. No possession with carrying a firearm, no possession with intent. it's 1,500 people in 1 year that get in prison, right? Now, by the same token, there's city legislators complaining that we have a diminished workforce and we don't have enough people to work. Well, these two go hand in hand. So not only is it, we have a do the crime, do the time mentality. That's fine. But what are the greater consequences, not just to that individual, but to society at large? What are the implications to the family and the workforce? That, the woman in Christina's story, that child is growing up without a father. We know that that's not healthy and happy, right? We know that that leads to worse outcomes for that child. What the impact that it's doing to the workforce, the impact that it'll do to this individual once they get out, and how they have this criminal record. Now, how difficult is it going to be for them to gain employment again and housing and all of the things that we know that they need to make society better for everyone? So it's not, even if you want to dismiss the person and whatever their humanity is in it and just say, you did the crime, let's do the time, you're not looking at the overall outcomes for the rest of society as well. There's no cost analysis in where it's beneficial. And not only that, it's not effective. We have incredibly high drug use rates in America, incredibly high addiction rates. And we also have some of the highest imprisonment rates in the world. So it statistically, it just doesn't bear out that it's effective in any manner.
Good. Yeah. Well, thinking in terms of that, just kind of effectiveness and maybe the lessons that we should have learned in the past before we started the drug war. There's a number of paradigm shifting statements in Christina's book, which, and I'd recommend people read it. But this one especially stuck out to me. She said, I always thought of prohibition as the ultimate form of regulation, but now I see it's really the absence of any form of regulation. It's a complete free-for-all. And so what she's highlighting there is that drug prohibition is first of all, not really a tried and true approach. It's largely a new one that we really gave the first test to during alcohol prohibition. But what happened in alcohol prohibition is that once you're not regulating anymore, once it's not in the open market, and even, you know, even libertarian listeners who don't like the idea of government regulation, the market also sort of regulates itself when it's out in the open, right? But black markets really don't function that same way. And so, you know, the point of, you know, so thinking back in prohibition, if it's not something that's out in the open market, it could be anything. It could be low quality. It could be too high alcohol content. It could be dangerous for you to drink, and there's nothing you can really do about it. There's no consequences for the manufacturers of that if they're giving you poison product. And that becomes, I think, at least one of the lessons for the drug war. And that perhaps open markets make even things that could be dangerous, like hard drugs, much safer. And so that there may be some unintended consequences here. And she gives another example of that, which I thought was really interesting, which was the slave buyback program. Do you remember that story in her book that she was talking about a ministry that she, as I think as a child, they may have gotten some of their stuff in the mail and they were asking for money for different things. And one of the things that this ministry had done overseas was a slave buyback. They were using their, you know, donate all this money, we'll buy people back from slavery. And so then once that happened, the slavers said, oh, there's a market for buying back slaves. We're going to enslave more people. And so that becomes an unintended consequence. And the ministry, to their credit, said, okay, that was a bad idea. We should have done that. We're not doing that again. Right. And so there, you know, as much as we may want to say, well, this, you know, slavery or, you know, drugs or whatever, that seems like a really bad thing. That doesn't mean that anything we do to combat it through the state is necessarily an effective solution. So like, what are some of the lessons that maybe we should have learned from things like prohibition that we haven't learned, that things that we, you know, should have made us think twice about the drug war?
What we did learn from alcohol prohibition is that it created far more societal ills than the harms it intended to fix, right? So anytime you have any product for which there is a demand, if it is no longer available on a legal regulated market, well, that means the illicit market is just eager to pick it up and run with it. The market demand doesn't cease just because something becomes illegal. And our, you know, I mean, the the example we have today is fentanyl. Why is fentanyl on the streets? Well, fentanyl is on the streets because we created a monster with OxyContin. And once the FDA was keenly aware of that, they put restrictions in place on prescribing OxyContin. So you have this FDA crackdown on the number of prescriptions that physicians can give out and the number of pills that pharmacists can dispense. Well, that didn't do anything for all of the people who were addicted to OxyContin. All that meant was that the easiest thing they could find now to feed their addiction, continue to feed that addiction developed by the OxyContin, was heroin, because it was easier to find heroin on the street than it was to get an OxyContin prescription, right? So then why do we have fentanyl? Well, fentanyl is a synthetic compound. It's a lot easier to get a synthetic compound than it is to grow poppies, harvest them, transport them across several ports. Bigger bang for your buck. The potency of fentanyl is between fentanyl and heroin is the difference between a marble and a basketball, right? So which of those two things are easier to smuggle? This is just a natural consequence of a prohibition model. This is what happens. Ultimately, drug traffickers are going to do what is ever in their best interest. And their best interest is more potency and less packaging. It gives them a higher profit margin. It also creates less risk for them. Now, this is what prohibition does.
Yeah. And, you brought up the prescription opioid, crisis or whatever. And, a lot of, films and news reports have really dramatized that and, made the doctors who are prescribing it and the pharmaceutical companies that produced it out to be these kind of, evil monsters or whatever. And there may be, I think, maybe an open question about whether it was prescribed more than it should have been. But you bring up a good point that the difference between, OxyContin, being on the open market, through prescription or whatever, but versus, okay, well, now that's not available. What else do you have? That we can't really beat the supply of, the law of supply and demand by banning safer substances. In fact, all that's really going to do is that demand will still be there, but now we're going to have to come up with other ways to satisfy those needs. And if it's going to happen in the black market, it's not going to be regulated. And as you pointed out, it's more likely to be more potent because they're trying to smuggle as much as they can across borders and as much of that, but as you said, it's you can get the more bang for your buck, right?
Right.
And so all of this criminalization ends up, whatever you want to say about the prescription opioid crisis, our criminalization ended up making the problem much worse, right? And so now we want to blame Mexico and Canada or whatever, but it happened because we banned safer opioids, right? If the war on drugs isn't the answer, how can we deal with drug addiction and its negative impacts on society? What can we do about this problem?
I think the most crucial thing is for us to address it as a health issue and not a criminal one. And right now, we're still kind of living in both worlds, right? With the way we enact our policies and the way we carry them out. Like you mentioned Canada and Mexico. Well, right now, Americans have been told that they need a 145% tariff on all the goods that they buy from China to stop the flow of fentanyl into the country, right? So that, and that puts it back in this criminalization issue. Well, then, of course, look at these people are hurting me because of their drug use. So, of course, I'm going to want to respond. And what is the most punitive way I can? It just kind of perpetuates this idea and takes us further and further away from the health model. The only portion of the export business that could care less about tariffs are drug traffickers. Right? Absolutely no impact on their work and their profit whatsoever. So I think we have to stop looking at it in terms of this criminalization issue and begin to look at it from the from the perspective of health. And I think one of the things that makes that or helps that is when we see what are the long-term effects when we do change our perspective and we do begin to treat it from a health perspective. We know that there were a lot of money between 2022 and 2024 that was put into recovery programs that were put into harm reduction measures like getting Narcan in more places. And it did make an impact. We saw a tremendous decrease, a noticeable decrease, 24% in 1 year in the overdose death rate in America. That's tremendous. So I think as long as we can keep having those conversations with people who are saying, you know, do the crime, do the time, and are saying, buck up and make better choices. If we can present the conversation to them, not just this is the impact on the individual of drugs, drug misuse, and criminalization of drugs, but this is the impact on the greater society at large. This is the reason that this neighborhood is quote unquote not safe because of prohibition, right? This is the reason that you have an overflowing jail system. This is the reason you don't have enough young men on your workforce. So we have to have all of those conversations with folks and introduce them to what are the outcomes of the policies that we have. You know, the vast majority of the American electorate, you put them all in a room and say, are our drug policies working? And they will say no, resoundingly. So if we can all start with that we can all agree that what we're currently doing and have been doing for pretty much 100 years now isn't working. And let's step back and look at the things that have. And what has worked is when we reframe our thinking and begin to address the complex health issue and identify things that the whole person needs to live a happy, successful life and not have the need for drugs in their life, right?
I don't think I mentioned. I hate asking questions about kind of specific stories and things like that because you may not have come with that fresh in your mind. But I know when I've talked about decriminalization, I've had friends recently who said, "Well, look at what happened in Portland. They decriminalized and it went horribly, and so they've had to recriminalize again." Someone who might sort of point to an example like that and say, "Well, look at that. Maybe criminalization isn't a panacea. Maybe it's not perfect, but obviously it was better than decriminalization, right? Because look at what happened in Portland." What would you say to maybe someone like that? And if you don't have an answer prepared, I can just cut it out. Just look at the letter.
So I think a couple of things. There are a bunch of things to look at when we look at the Portland model. And I completely understand why people said, "Yeah, this was a failed experiment. Didn't work. We're going back." One thing that we didn't do in Portland is that the money that was coming around to help with the recovery portion, the health portion for people who were in active addiction, didn't hit until like 18 months out after the change of after Proposition 110 went into place. So you can't approach things that way, right? If we're going to say we're going to change this model, then you've got to get those recovery beds open beforehand. You've got to get MAT clinics beforehand. You have to open various ways to recovery. You can't put the cart in front of the horse. And I think that's one thing that very much so happened there. We've got to build out that medical infrastructure before we can just say, all right, now let's legalize. We have to give people, you can't just give people access to drugs and not give them access to care, right? The second thing that happened with that is there were no public use laws that happened in conjunction with that. So if we take drug alcohol, for instance, we have safe public consumption sites, right? But in most cities in America, you can't just walk down the street drinking, right? I grew up in the South, so I know New Orleans, and that's a different story. But for most of America, if you're walking down the street with a 40, you're going to get pulled over. That's going to get taken from you. So we didn't create any laws to protect the greater public in that sense. And those things have to be in place as well, just like we create for alcohol. There can't just be harm reduction policies that we enact that are good for the user. We have to create harm reduction policies that are good for those who choose not to use as well. If only one segment of the population is benefiting from a law, not a good law. And I think that, so it was kind of a perfect storm of things that were not done on the front end before Proposition 110 went into play. So that's what I would say about it. There's a lot of great information to read out there about it and kind of what went wrong. But really those two pieces, not getting that funding in place towards more treatment before they decriminalize, and not putting those safeguards in place for the rest of the general public.
Yeah, well, and I could imagine maybe someone who's sort of more conservative saying, oh, okay, now we got to put all this money into healthcare. It's like, well, we're currently putting it into prisons. So, but whereas somebody who maybe is a little more libertarian, who'd be a little bit sort of skeptical of policy solutions in general. Mm. One other thing I noticed about the Portland thing is, you know, like, oh, we have additional fentanyl deaths or something. You know, those are sort of concerns. It's like, well, yes, but what's going on in Portland is that you're not necessarily going to get in trouble for using, but we're still living in the same sort of broader drug war system where the hard drugs that are easier to get are what's being produced. And so that's
the interesting thing about the fentanyl portion is as long as illicit substances have been coming into the country, they always start in the Northeast. That's where they come in. And they slowly make their way across America. That was very much so true with fentanyl. It just so happened that that was, as Proposition 110 went into place, coincided with fentanyl making its way to the West Coast. I mean, and I think that the Cato Institute actually has a pretty good paper out there on that. But again, perfect storm.
Gotcha.
You know, and if people have access to codeine or lesser grade narcotics, you know, they're not looking for fentanyl. Most people don't start with fentanyl, right? Yeah. It is not the go-to. So, it was a shot that just too many things not in place to make that work out, and too many other bad things going in at the same time.
Right. Okay, so I've got another maybe pushback question for you. So,
okay.
And this is maybe a little bit of a broader question, going back to sort of class and things like that, which it doesn't solve all of our questions related to drugs, even though that's the stereotype. But so the question would be, so I maybe the background first is I've been a bit involved in different kind of programs aimed at the poor in my own community through my church. And for me, that experience has certainly humanized folks whose experience is different than mine, which is an important part of that. But it's also underlined, I think, how poverty can be kind of a cycle that could be perpetuated by choices that we make and that we sort of emulate and seeing others make. And so, like, you know, yes, it's very difficult to do something different when you're reared in drug addiction or abusive relationships or financial mismanagement or absent parents or whatever. But it's also true that if just, you know, one chain in that link, one generation, you know, avoids drugs, finishes high school, doesn't get pregnant out of wedlock, there's a pretty good chance that that cycle can be broken, that they'll be they'll sort of be in the middle class, that they'll live a pretty good life. And so as I read Christina's story, it was plain that she was basically a conservative who needed to learn a progressive lesson. But isn't it maybe also true that progressives need to learn sort of a conservative lesson, that maybe, a conservative might say, well, maybe, you know, addicts just need to buck up and make better choices if they want a better life. that's a crude way of saying it, but is there any truth to that? Is there a danger that we, you know, in the interest of compassion, that we are undermining personal responsibility?
Free will is an interesting thing, right? I had a described to me one time as, you know, you wake up in the morning, you're grabbing a pair of socks out of sock drawer, but all you have is the socks that are available in your sock drawer, right? So I think that things like poverty, cycles of trauma that can happen in multi-generations are really complex. And I think if we look at it at a place where we say, just buck up and make the wrong choice, I think we're really not looking at how intense all of those things can kind of play together. One of the things that I wish more people understood is poverty has impact on the brain. Childhood poverty has an impact on a developing brain. We know that children who grow up in chronic poverty have less gray matter in the prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex is involved in our emotional regulation. It's involved in decision-making. It's involved in the reward circuitry of the brain. So for us to just say, make a better choice, I think maybe that is missing that empathy piece. So let's just say, even if we can't get to that, right? Like, okay, but you still should have made better choices. Well, then we have to say, then the choice becomes the choice of society, right? We have a choice in this instance. Do we want to make a choice of imprisonment for a harm in which there are a crime in which there were no victims, a victimless crime, and then perpetuate the harms that this person already endured in their life? Or do we want to make a choice and say, you know what, we're going to try a diversion tactic, and we're going to see if we can get you some resources that you need through this diversion tactic and see if you can have better outcomes for your life. As far as ultimately, that's more cost effective. We've seen that it's far more cost effective to put people through diversion programs than it is to imprison them. So of course, we'd all be better off if we made better choices, right? I mean, but that's a very easy, quick response. And I don't think that anyone is not without personal accountability for the choices they make. Of course they are. We have a goal in society, should always be to do what we can to be working towards making it more civil, right? And what is the best way we can do that when people do make bad choices?
Mm-hmm.
How can we help them get past that?
Yeah, that's fair. That's good. Kind of following the vein of kind of thinking through what your critics might say, what do you think the strongest argument from the other side is for treating drugs as a criminal issue primarily rather than as a health issue? When you talk to people who are skeptical of what End It For Good is doing, what do you think is the most difficult objection to answer that you've come across?
Well, I think the most difficult objection really with any big issue is the fear. You know, it's scary to do something new. It's scary to take such a massively huge shift in our thinking about how to do something differently. The only way really to kind of help folks with that, I think, is to let them see that there are places. Okay, we do have Portland. That didn't work out. But there are places in smaller scales where we have seen some changes made and we've seen great outcomes. So I think that's always the most difficult objection for me, is to help people see that it's not that your fear is unfounded. Whatever we're afraid of, there's reason for it. But let's look at what is the factual thing surrounding it and what that fear is based in. Is it based in reality? Is it based in real outcomes that we've seen? We see people who recover every day, right? And so we know that it is possible to have a better way to deal with drugs and addiction.
That's good. I've talked a lot as kind of using Christina Dent's backstory as kind of a, you know,
yeah,
way to think about this, but maybe just kind of briefly, I'd like to talk a little about your own story. You did talk with Alex on the Protestant Libertarian podcast about your own personal story. And which is not without pain. And so I worry that asking you to come in and talk about your own kind of personal pain is kind of an unpleasant thing. But insofar as you're comfortable and open to sharing it, I'd like to maybe let our audience know just a little bit about what brought you to be involved in It For Good. Why is it an important mission for you?
Mm-hmm. So I lost my firstborn child, Asa, ultimately to addiction, to drug use. And because of the circumstances of his death and the outcomes of his death, I had to reevaluate my own thinking on things, right? So my son had been in and out of problematic drug use for, I guess at that time, probably about six years when he passed. We had some great months of clarity, and then we had some really bad months of real hard drug use. But I think what happened for my son is that he had a court case coming up in which he was really convinced that he was going to be given a three strikes, you're out kind of deal. And it was he had a driving under the influence possession charge. And that case and the fear of what was going to happen to him really became, I think, overwhelming. And so he did what he had done to cope with pain and fear before, which he went back to using. And at the time, opiates was something, even though he'd had years of problematic drug use, opiates was something he'd never really messed with. He just kind of, there was kind of a line there. And I think he had some fear around those things. And he did start to use opiates. And really within 2 months, he was dead. So the thing about my son's death that really made me change my mind, particularly on legalization, is that we anticipated, this is in 2019, that his death was the result of a supply contaminated with fentanyl. But after the autopsy, it was discovered that there was no fentanyl in his system. And in fact, there was not a lethal amount of any illicit substance in his system. What killed my son is that he used with a friend, and he didn't feel well and told his friend he wanted to leave. And when he went outside, he passed out. And it was a night where it got to 19 degrees, which in Southeast Mississippi is really never happened, and really cold. And so the people in that house, they had a choice to make, right? We can call 911. Are we all going to go to jail? Because here's this guy, he came over, used drugs, I sold him, and he's passed out in my driveway. So they chose not to call 911. And ultimately, my son died of hypothermia. That is what would killed him. So in having to work through that, I had to reevaluate, are the laws that we have in place, and we have a law in place called Parker's Law in Mississippi, which is a homicide law, drug-induced homicide law, are they helpful, right? Actually, we're known if it was more out. And we also had to have a good Samaritan law in Mississippi, though, right? So ideally, if you call and someone is overdosed on your property, there shouldn't be any charges. But in my thinking, and it took me a long time to get here, because man, did I want vengeance on that kid for not calling 911. But what finally occurred to me is that if we had a legalized, regulated market, my son was probably still misusing drugs. But there would have been a framework where the people that he used with, the people he associated with, understood that they could call 911. They're probably much more likely to have access to Narcan if that were the case. And that my son would still be alive. So that, you know, I think prior to that experience, I did believe in decriminalization. I thought that was a good thing. But it really wasn't until that experience that I understood exactly how dangerous, really, and backwards our prohibition model is. And this is one of the extreme cases that can come from that model. So that's my backstory.
I'm really sorry, Jane.
Thank you.
Well, and so, you know, as you talked about earlier, this drug addiction is not just a problem that you sort of have in bad families, right? You know,
right.
It's something you've experienced yourself. And but I of course, even if it was, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have compassion for people who are struggling with drug addiction. But I think that, you know, there was a black comedian, African American comedian, one time who said something like, you know, when they say that drugs are an epidemic, that means white people are doing them.
Right.
And right. You know, but, you know, the sense of the fact that this is not, you know, as much as we may want to sort of look at people who struggle with drug addiction and see them a certain way, In a lot of cases, we may not always know it yet, but they could be, you know, our family or our friends or our neighbors. And so it's more, we should treat it, maybe we should see it as more personal than maybe we do at times. Maybe to shift gears just a little bit. The work for End It For Good points to the ways in which binary thinking has led to destructive results, right? So I think libertarians in particular will appreciate that, because we're always trying to sort of suggest a third way beyond the two-party system. And, one binary here is a legal one, which is that there are only two approaches to drugs, which are ban them or celebrate them, right? Yeah. And I think another binary that ended for good questions is between addiction and total abstinence. And that was an interesting point in the book, you know, because I'm part of a church that has Celebrate Recovery, and I'm sort of aware of the kind of recovery model, which tends to be kind of a bare knuckle sobriety model.
Right.
What was interesting about the book, about Christina's book, and about some of the work that you guys do, is that you are not necessarily inclined to think that that's always the right answer. Can you speak just a little bit about that? We're getting close to an hour, but I thought that was an interesting point, maybe worth discussing.
Yeah, I think the more tools in our tool belt, the better outcomes. And so that is how we look at recovery. You take 100 people, put them in a room, all with an addiction story. It's a different story. So why wouldn't we anticipate that there are different routes that people need to take to get to their sobriety? When it comes to cancer, any medical condition, we applaud medical breakthroughs and new sciences and new ways of doing things. I think we have to look at addiction that way as well. Every day we are getting further and further along in our understanding of addiction science. Neuroscience is kind of the last frontier of the medical exploration. And it's incredible the leaps and bounds we've come really just in the past 20 years. And that directly impacts our understanding of addiction and how to treat it. So we believe that the more tools you can have in your tool belt that can help people get to a place where they can sustain and gives them another day to get the chance to make that choice towards recovery, right? And the better off we are. And I was reading the other day, this is new to me, that Bill W., founder of AA, he created that program in the 1930s, and that is the gold standard for our thinking on recovery, right? And in 1956, he participated in an LSD study at the VA in Los Angeles. And what he came across with from that study was, for those people that he referred to as cynical alcoholics, LSD might present a way for these individuals to get that higher power piece that they haven't been able to get before. That he did see it, that it could be used as another way to help people along in recovery. So I think we don't need to be so dogmatic. I think when we start looking at things and saying like there's just one way, then that tells me that we're thinking back to drug use as purely a criminal issue, and we're not looking at it from the perspective of a medical issue and health. And the more we can reframe that, I think the more that will open up people's understanding of why recovery, there should be multiple pathways to it. And we should celebrate any way that somebody gets to a place of sustained better living.
What are some practical things that listeners can do to challenge the status quo? Where can they find End It For Good? Maybe that's part of the answer, is working with End It For Good.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing I have to recommend is Christina's book, Curious. It really is such a great read, and she does such an amazing job of introducing the stories of other people who have, in one way or another, been impacted by our current drug policies. And right now, I would love to give like 5 copies to anybody who wants to get in touch with us. We will mail those to you. If you guys can email us, you can email me, jane@enditforgood.com, and I'll send you out that copy. But I would love for more people to read that, because I think when you've read it, it does this really great job of taking these big, scary issues and putting them in a way that's very easy to see and in a way that it doesn't feel scary to accept these big changes at all. So I would definitely recommend that book. And I think the other thing that we need to do is, you know, that book makes it easy for you to have a way to talk to people. It gives you insight into how to have those conversations. Man, have those conversations. You know, sometimes they are hard. It's a contentious topic, right? And it's, you know, it's getting even more contentious right now all of a sudden. And so we have to not be afraid to have the difficult conversation around those difficult subjects. It's the only way we fix them is if we head them face on.
I love that answer.
Face them head on. Oh, sorry.
I love the answer that talking about it is important, because I think sometimes that's what's frustrating for people who care about issues like this, is that we talk about it all the time and we feel like nothing's changing, but politics is downstream from culture. And right. So it's only by really having these conversations and changing minds that something really could be different someday. And so it may seem like it's an insignificant thing to just talk about it, but it actually could be really important. At a certain point, you get to a critical mass if we're all doing that, right?
That's right. You gotta shift the over to the window.
There you go. So End It For Good, where do people find that?
So you can find us online. It's just enditforgood.com. We're also on Facebook and on Instagram. You can find us there, but we've got a lot of great resources. Again, I'd love to send you a copy of Christina's book. We also, Christina does a podcast. It's had a lot of great guests on here. We also have a great list of resources. That's just like there's a list of books there. If you want to take a deeper dive into the subject, we've got some articles posted, written by some of our friends at other think tanks. And so that's a great place to catch us. It's just on the website, and you can get in touch with any of us there.
Awesome. I want to thank you, Jane, for making the time to talk with us. It's been a really
great... Thanks so much for having us.
Informative conversation.
Thank you for this podcast. An awesome thing, man. We need more of this out there. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, I agree. Thank you, Jane.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished. you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.